Tired of trying diet after diet without results? Mochi Health offers a long-term weight loss solution personalized to your needs. Our board-certified obesity doctors and registered dietitians provide expert guidance to help you succeed. Eligible patients can access custom-formulated GLP-1 medication at an affordable set price delivered monthly. Take our free quiz at joinmochi.com and use code AUDIO40 for $40 off your first month. That's joinmochi.com.
A lot of this book is me putting characters in my evil writerly way, putting characters into bad situations in a box and then shake the box up a little bit and see what kind of pops out.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Positively Trek with me, Dan Gunther. And this is a special book episode. And we've got a special co-host brought back. We've brought him out of mothballs and dusted him off. Bruce Gibson. Bruce, welcome back to Positively Trek.
Thank you. Last time I was here was, about a month ago? A few weeks ago? Something. It wasn't that long ago. But yeah, it's great to be back again and talk Star Trek books.
Yeah, well, this is a rarity these days in the Star Trek publishing world. Things have slowed down quite a bit in the publishing of new books. But when this comes along, we really do want to celebrate it and make note of it and do something special. So, of course, with the recent release of the Star Trek Strange New Worlds novel, Toward the Night, by James Swallow, we had to get the man himself on the show to talk about the book. So please join me in welcoming the wonderful James Swallow back to Positively Trek. James, welcome back.
It's a pleasure to be here. It's always lovely to talk to you. Thanks for having me back on the show.
Absolutely. Well, yeah, like I said, this is kind of it's a big deal when a Star Trek novel is released, and it's something that we really like to talk about on this show and kind of give a bump as much as we can. And having just finished this novel in the wee hours of the night last night, I can say this one is really worth talking about, and we're really, really glad to have you here. Let's start, I guess, by talking a little bit about the state of Star Trek publishing right now, because things have slowed down a bit. We're not kind of up to the level of a novel a month like we were back in the day. The landscape really has changed quite a bit. And of course, like we said, it's been quite a while since we've talked to you, and it's been a while since the last novel came out. How are you finding this kind of new paradigm in the Star Trek publishing world?
Well, there's been a bit of a shift in focus of things of late. So right now, Simon Schuster is concentrating on the kind of the what we consider like the secret hideout shows, you know, the shows that are all coming from that production company. So we're seeing a lot more tie-ins to what's current on television and less for the older series. That's why right now a lot of the focus is on Strange New Worlds. We've had, we got High Country, I think, at the beginning of the year, or was it at the end of last year? John Jackson Miller's book.
Yeah, that sounds right.
And then we just had, before that, we had Una McCormack's Asylum. Now we have My Novel Night, and we're going to have another one, which is Dave Mack's Ring of Fire, which will be coming out towards the end of the year. So currently the focus is on that, but there is some other stuff coming out. I think Greg Cox has Identity Crisis, I think. Mm-hmm. Identity Theft. Yeah. And that's a classic Trek novel, so that one's coming out as well. Beyond that, I know of some other books that are in the works. I can't really say more than that, but there's stuff going on. There has been definitely sort of a step change of things right now. And also, you know, we've just recently suffered a quite a personal loss. Is one of our esteemed editors, Margaret Clark, who's been with us for so many years. She passed away very recently, very mm-hmm. suddenly, which is a great shame. And, you know, we all feel that loss very, very keenly. And so that has meant that things have kind of slowed down as well. But stepping into the big shoes, filling those big shoes, is our good friend Scott Pearson, who has been working on as a line editor on the Star Trek line for quite a while. So I can't think of anybody more suited to take over the job than him. And I'm sure once he gets back up to speed, you know, we're going to be seeing Star Trek books going from strength to strength. In terms of the release schedule, that's way above my pay grade. as I say, there are new books on the way, stuff that hasn't been announced yet. So the, it's not like the line's winding down or anything like that.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. Margaret Clark, we were so sad to hear about her passing, for sure. Bruce and I had the opportunity a few years back, I think that was on Literary Treks back in the day, we spoke with her, and just an incredibly warm and giving person, and we learned so much from her about, the Star Trek publishing world and what that looks like and stuff. And yeah, I was absolutely shocked to see that news. So a huge loss for sure.
Yeah, I wasn't expecting. I didn't know anything, and then to see that was a big surprise and very sad. And not only did we get to talk to her once and get to know her that way, but we've got to know her through you, the authors, because so many times you'd come on the show and the authors, like you yourself, would say, "Well, this idea actually came from Margaret," or "Margaret decided to take this and this story, and I thought it was a great idea and stuff." So we know the contributions that she made, and yeah, it's a sad situation.
I mean, speaking personally, I've been writing Star Trek books now for nearly 20 years. And I think it's like 12 books, almost maybe like one or two that I didn't work on with her. So she's been sort of like a, a guiding hand through my work for the Star Trek prose for a very long time. And as I say, she will be definitely missed. Just a very unique, iconoclastic, kind of quirky, fun, interesting person. She was so much joy in life to her, and so much fun to work with her. And she is, she will be sorely missed. But in a way, that if you just look at the body of work that's been out in the last, there's no Star Trek work out there that doesn't have her fingerprints on it. So, she leaves behind a legacy of great writing.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. And including this book that we're talking about today. Was
Definitely.
she involved, right? Yeah.
In fact, one of the things I was sad about is that Margaret's passing came so quickly. The book is already in print, because I would have loved to have I always thank my editorial team in the acknowledgements, but I would have loved to have put a dedication in there to the to Margaret. But I believe that Dave Mack is going to kind of do that for all of us with Ring of Fire.
I guess let's get right into that then, because I was curious about that, as I am with every one of the novels that comes out. Where did the kind of initial impetus, where did the origin of this novel come from? Was this an idea that you pitched, or did this come from editorial? How did this get started?
Well, it was from our good friend Kirsten Beyer over at Star Trek headquarters. Said, I'd like to get Jim to come in and do a Strange New Worlds novel, which was, again, always really lovely to have that happen, to be asked to come over and contribute to something, especially to doing a tie-in to what is right now the current new Trek, the hot new flavor of what we're getting of Star Trek. So having the opportunity to contribute a little bit to that was really cool. They pretty much gave me, though, carte blanche. The there was some at the time we were going to make the book fit in with season three, because I think that the time of the plans were that the show was going to be airing earlier. So the only major change we really went through was when we realized the TV show wasn't going to be coming out in time to sync up with the book. Margaret said to me, Kristen wants you to kind of reorganize things. Can you set it somewhere else?" And as it was fairly easy for me to kind of, it was because it's designed to be a standalone story. It was easy enough for me to kind of take it and just move it back a little bit. So now it sits in the middle of season two, between the episodes. It's the Among the Lotus Eaters and Charades, so it fits in between those two stories. There's a nice little gap there. But in terms of the core, without getting into spoilers at this point, that actually kind of came from a good friend of mine who, a longtime Star Trek fan, one of my old buddies, Michael Clark, guy who I have been in Star Trek fandom for years, and Mike's also like a gamer, and he enjoys the Star Trek Adventures RPG, tabletop RPG. And we were having one of those discussions where we were talking about ideas for game scenarios. And he was chatting to me about this concept he had for a story that followed up on the plot line of the Doomsday Machine. And again, I have to be careful what I say, because I don't want to spoil it, but some of the elements he was talking about this kind of moral dilemma story that he had, I thought that was a really cool idea. And I said, that's really interesting to play with that. And I said, I think I might borrow that if you don't mind. And Mike was like, yeah, go for it. So the germ of the idea came from this conversation with Mike. And then as I started building on that, I thought, well, what's the stuff in Stranger Worlds that I really like? I mean, I really enjoy the character of Pike, and I really like the character of Ortegas, and I felt like she hadn't been as well served with stories, like spotlight stories, as she could have been. So to me, I wanted to make sure that she got a strong character narrative throughout this plot. And I wanted to give Pike some fun stuff to do. And then, of course, looking at the rest of the characters, all the characters are such fun. I thought, well, I'm just going to, try and find something interesting for everybody in the show to do and mesh all that together with this sort of moral dilemma story. And that basically became the sort of genesis of what became Toward the Night.
Yeah, without getting into too many spoilers yet, we'll definitely do that later. I did really appreciate that aspect, how each character kind of got a really interesting thing to do in each part of the book, even in ways that maybe weren't as expected, but fit that character perfectly. And we'll get into some specific ones later, but I really appreciate that. I love when a writer can write an ensemble so well, like with this one here.
And it's a great ensemble cast. I mean, I couldn't, hand on heart, I have to say, I couldn't do this if it wasn't such a great cast, if they didn't have such strong voices and strong tonalities to them. I've already seen a early review and someone said, oh, you did a really great job getting the voices of the characters right. And I'm like, it's all on the screen. I'm just echoing what I've seen, what the actors are portraying, strong characterization. So it makes it really easy for me to pick that up and say, well, this is Pike's voice, or this is Una's voice, this is the young Spock, this is Chapel, what have you. This is how to find the this is the thing you do with every tie-in work, is find that tone, find that texture, find that essential voice, and try and make it come to life on the page. And of course, with a book, because you've got more kind of screen time, as it were, you have the opportunity to give everybody that kind of moment in the spotlight that maybe they might not have in a 45-minute episode of a TV show.
One of the things you mentioned was actually something that I had in the notes to ask about, because we heard something very similar from Una McCormack about her novel Asylum, that it was also supposed to be kind of set in a season three area, but they kind of had to rework it a bit to fit it back into season two. Was there a lot that you had to rework with this, or was it a fairly easy, seamless transition to kind of reorient where it is in the history of Strange New Worlds, I guess.
Oh, pretty easy, really. I mean, again, I deliberately designed it to try and be as self-contained as possible. So for precisely that reason. So we could just kind of drop it into any point in the season three continuity. Because at the time they were keeping us in the loop, so sending us the scripts for the third season. I was reading those stories and thinking, okay, well, does it fit well between episodes three and four, or should it be five and six, or what have you? And I deliberately designed it to have no kind of connective matter. There is, well, I say no connective matter. There is a little bit. There are. It's. There's a couple of kind of what are now would have been kind of current references had it come out in season three. They are now kind of call forward references. So there's stuff in there that might not actually make sense to you as a reader right now, but when you see the episode, like in a couple of months' time, you'll go, oh, that's a reference to the thing that hasn't happened yet. So I had to kind of tweak things there a little bit, but it was nothing sort of, no really serious major headaches that made me kind of think, oh God, I've got to take it to pieces and rebuild the whole story. It was pretty, pretty easy.
Kind of turns it into future Easter eggs for future readers to
Yeah,
find, I
in a
guess. I
way,
like
yeah.
that.
That was kind of fun. I had to dial back a little bit some of the references, because there's one of the things I did is there's a name check in there for Ortegas's brother, who will be a character in season three. So there was going to be a little bit more about that guy, so I had to kind of trim that out. But now that looks great, because I have her ha having a moment where she's thinking about him, and you're going to meet him in the next season. So that's a nice kind of connectivity there.
Oh, I love that. I love that kind of stuff. That's good to know. That's great to know. Did they give you like a series Bible, or are you just going based on the scripts and what you've seen on screen?
Well, I mean, at this point, I pretty much know Star Trek, so I don't think, there's we don't I don't need to kind of know who these characters are, because you've seen them right there on the screen. But they were sending me all of the episodes. I got to read, I think, everything except the season finale for season three. They were keeping that one definitely under wraps. And that was a lot of fun. And of course, that was like almost like a year ago. So I've been having to kind of keep my lip zipped about everything that's going on. You know, I see every time a trailer drops, or people are going, "Oh my God, I can't believe that actor's in it," or "This thing is going on." And I'm like, if only you knew. It's quite crazy, you know, to see the thing that always makes me laugh is when I see people talking about what they think is going to happen. And I'm like, there's one guy, there's like 20 people talking about it. I'm like, well, one guy has got it right, and everybody else is way off base. And I think that one guy in like 3 months from now, he's going to be like, "I totally called it. You guys were all wrong." It's just fun to see that, you know, all the speculation when you know what really is going
Oh, I'm incredibly jealous, but
on.
that's great.
Let me
We'll
say,
get there.
I'll just say this. There's some really good episodes coming up. I mean, some really, really fun stuff. I can't wait to see it.
Well, let's get into, I guess, the actual story here, and we'll just kind of set it up and then give a warning for spoilers. But yeah, this involves this a strange new world, which is always welcome. This planet that seems to have been wiped out had an environmental cataclysm, basically, from which there's this they discover that it's kind of a distress call, and they're checking it out. And yeah, I guess this is probably the point we should just say, okay, spoilers here, I guess, because yeah, we can't really talk too much more about it without getting into spoilers. So yeah, we have this world that's seemingly been abandoned because the environment dramatically shifted. And I love the kind of mystery of what's going on with this planet, 685 Gamma, or as we learn, it's called Sakaar. I personally was trying to figure out the mystery of where these people had gone throughout the entire book. And my mind was kind of going to Sarpedon and the Atavacron in All Our Yesterdays, and
Yeah, there's a little conceptual nod towards that, definitely.
yeah, I appreciated that for sure. So where did the idea of this kind of planetary shift forward, I guess, come from for this planet?
It was actually the germ of that idea was from a story idea I had, a pitch for Voyager, for Star Trek Voyager back in the 1990s, about a group of we. In the TNG episode Relics, there's that whole story where, you know, Scotty is trapped in the transport buffer and brought back, you know, decades later. And I always thought that was a really cool idea, is if you could do that with somebody, instead of kind of putting them into physical suspended animation, what if you could, you know, kind of Tron style digitize them just as raw data? And what if you could do that? What if you could do that with objects and maybe even an entire planetary population? And that idea stuck in my head, and I played around with a Voyager story where that was going to happen to some members of the crew of Voyager. So, you know, never throw any ideas away, right? That was in my kind of box of like unused ideas. And I thought, this is a really cool idea to kind of create this planet, you know, these people who their culture is that they don't want to leave their home world, although they have the technology to do that. Their society is so connected to their planet that they feel to them, we can't leave. It's almost like a kind of religious belief for them, is that that's anathema to them to go off planet. So it's all, how do we save ourselves? So they build this, what is the equivalent of like a storm shelter, because their star is going into this flare star stage and it's bombarding their planet with radiation. And so they build, instead of going kind of underground because they know the radiation is going to seep into the planet, they build this device to put themselves into kind of transporter stasis and wait. And just what the entire population of the planet is just to wait this catastrophic environmental change. Just wait for it to go, and then they can kind of walk back out the door and pick up where their lives left off. And our characters stumble upon the planet when it's in this kind of dead phase. They have no idea what is going on here. They just have pieces of this story about this missing society. And the technology that the people living on this planet have created, that ends up being the mechanism our heroes use to save the day.
I did really enjoy that story, and the little clues that kind of are going throughout, like the revelation, like you mentioned, that you know they have this belief that they'll never leave their planet. So you're kind of in your head, you're crossing off, okay, well, they didn't all beam away then, like where are they? And I love how you kind of piece that together over the course of the novel, for sure, which of course ties it into something from Starfleet's past, which was a really fun exploration as well with the USS Baldwin, this Freedom class starship, like the Franklin from Star Trek Beyond. What made you decide to kind of connect to that era? Because that was a lot of fun.
Well, I've always liked the Enterprise era. And I've always thought that I'd love to that world. I mean, you know, in the TV show, we concentrate a lot on that crew of characters, but I was always fascinated by the Starfleet of that era, the kind of early Starfleet. So for me, it was fun to revisit that. And again, it's interesting to reflect the characters of the kind of like Pike's era Enterprise versus what is kind of a few years past Jonathan Archer kind of era Enterprise. Different people, different attitudes, you know, as the personalities are changing, as the nature of what Starfleet is and what Starfleet's mission is has changed, that reflects in the people, the personnel who serve. So it's fun to play with those ideas, put these two different groups of people together, people from the past and people from the present, as it were, and see how their attitudes are dissimilar, but also see how their attitudes are similar. And that was exciting for me to do that. And I just, you know, being a Trek tech starship nerd, I thought it would be fun to bring back the Freedom class ship from Star Trek Beyond, which I think is a cool, really sort of clunky, old school, chunky metal starship. And I just like the design of it. And I thought it would be fun to bring that back. So all of these were just like, you know, little things that I really enjoyed, gradually finding a way to weave that all into one story to make it fun for me as a writer to write, and also hopefully fun for readers as well.
Yeah, because I sometimes read like a Star Trek novel where something similar like this might happen, where you have the current crew and then they find a ship or a crew from the past, and it's usually before Starfleet. But I like the fact that it's the early years and the Jonathan Archer years, for lack of better words for it, but just to have that time frame in there, because they're both Starfleet officers, but from different times, and they have to relate to each other in that manner. And so that was entertaining to me, for them, the Makos, to see, what are these officers like? You know, what things are like in the future that are different from what they have now. So a phaser isn't like such a strange thing to them or anything. They know what it is. It's just more advanced, you know.
And that makes it interesting as well, because these people, they don't look at like the future characters and go, "What are you? Where are you from?" They right. get who they are, but the fact that it's just slightly different, in fact, actually kind of amplifies the suspicions and the differences between these people, because, well, I know this looks like a phaser, but it's not quite. What's going on here? And, you know, and it'd be a whole different kind of relationship. And in the early scenes when these two groups are brought together, there's a lot of suspicion, because Pike is trying not to mess with the timeline. And so he doesn't want these people to know who he is or where they come from. And he's doing his best to kind of, you know, we can't interfere. We can't mess with any of this, because the history of these people has already been written. And, you know, if we do one thing wrong, it's the, you know, it's the ripple effect. And so that's first and foremost in Pike's mind. And from the point of view of the characters in the past, they're like, well, who is this guy? And why is he keeping things from us? And, you know, we can't trust him. And so immediately it creates this friction, this tension between these characters who should be on the same side, and they are, but they're, you know, they're keeping stuff from each other. And immediately that's great drama, because these characters are just butting heads all through the core of the story.
I thought that, I mean, it makes sense, right? It's the prime directive. You go back to the past, you don't reveal the future, you don't say who you are. But I thought, well, since these characters, since our crew believes that they're going to die on this planet, there's a part of me that thought, well, why not say anything? As long as you don't, you know, whisk them away back to Earth or anything, they could die knowing that they're from these, you know, Pike and them are from the future. What does it matter?
Well, I suppose what it is that, you know, what's known about them is they're kind of missing, presumed dead. So they don't know 100% that these people die. And of course, that little kind of bit of wiggle room, that ends up being the doorway to the kind of finale of the story.
Right.
Not to mention, like, there is a fear that they do have a warp capable shuttlecraft there, so they could potentially hijack it and return back to civilization and really mess things up too. So
yeah, I mean, and there's a point in the story where, you know, where they say, well, can, you know, can we have your shuttle, can we get off this planet? Can we have your shuttlecraft? And Pike's like, no, because that's technology, that's 100 years in advance. And just, in the database on board that ship is 100 years of future history. And if it falls into the wrong hands, it could have catastrophic effects. But what I really wanted to get into was the, we've seen this kind of story before on Star Trek, these kind of moral dilemmas. But I really wanted to get into the kind of nitty-gritty of it, because sometimes when we get stories like this, they're very academic and they're very kind of intellectual. And you think it's a trolley problem kind of story. It's like, how many people would you sacrifice in order to save a larger number of people? Needs of the many, needs of the few, that kind of thing. But it's very easy to have that conversation at a remove, not when you're looking that person in the eye and going, yeah, you know what? I'm going to have to leave you here to die. And these are real people with real personalities, decent, good people. They're not bad guys who you go, it doesn't matter if these guys die. These are your friends. These are your colleagues. How does it feel to have to look somebody in the eye and make that kind of decision? And what kind of creation of real relationship does that have? How does that affect those interrelationships? That's what I really wanted to get into, from the oblique academic nature of it, and say, no, this is happening to you right now. And if you were in that situation, would you have that moral question and you can't look away from it, what choice do you make? And Pike, because he's such a strongly morally centered character, that's great to just hand him that ball and go, there you go, you figure that out, Chris. What are you going to do with that? And that was really fun to write.
Yeah, that it really reminded me of the TNG episode "A Matter of Time" with Berlingoff Rasmussen, who wasn't actually from the future, but Picard's argument with him, right? Like, my future's not written yet. Like, how do you know? Blah blah blah, and it's flipping that so that the people you're dealing with, you're the one from the future now, and I really enjoyed that story for sure. Another aspect I really liked was, because of the era that they're from, they're a little closer to the eugenics wars. It's not quite as distant in the past. And that reaction to seeing La'an Noonien Singh's name on the back of her insignia, that was, you wrote that so well, just like the visceral gasp. That was really good.
Yeah, I mean, part of that was the character La'an, with she's got such great depth and dynamic. I really like the idea that she's this sort of distant descendant of Khan. But I wanted to do a little bit more with that, because we know in her past that she's had to deal with prejudice because of that. But we don't really see a lot of that in the show. So I thought it would be interesting to put that right up in front of her face and show, the readers her dealing with that situation, and then put it from a point of view where the person who's saying it to her is not unsympathetic. Somebody who, the it's Rix, the character is the name of the character, the medic from the Baldwin. As he explains, he says that, I didn't live through the eugenics wars, but I was raised by the generation of war orphans who lost all of their families during the eugenics wars. My parents and grandparents are the survivors of that. And if you think of how that generational trauma would have affected his parents and grandparents, and how that would have been passed down to him, and his reaction to it, that's why he has that strong, visceral kind of, his hackles go up, and immediately he assumes that she's a bad person and that she's there to do them harm. How does he learn to get past that? And her story is, how does she react to it in a way that isn't immediately aggressive and isn't immediately kind of confirming his worst fears? Because La'an is somebody who's very much, she's very straight down the line, and she has a very aggressive, straightforward reaction to things. And she has to kind of temper herself, because she knows that if she kind of comes out towards this guy and sort of, like, tells him to, get the hell out, she knows that's going to create trouble for them. So she has to temper her own reaction to it. But at the same time, it's something that she's like, oh God, not this again. I thought I came from a place where we got past this, and now I have to deal with it again. So again, great opportunity for kind of friction between these characters.
Yes, thank you, thank you. Because Lon is one of my favorite characters, and when she was out, when they thought she could be dying, I was like, oh no, she's probably going to be sitting out this entire novel until the end. But that didn't happen, and we got what you just explained, so I was very pleased with that.
Yeah, one of my favorite scenes in that moment is when she wakes up And she says to Pike, "What am I doing here? Why are we here? We shouldn't be among these people." And Pike says, "Well, if we didn't take you down to meet them, you would have died." And she said, "You should have let me die, because we can't mess with time." Because of course that ties back into her personal experiences,
Yes.
tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow. And she's like, "I've done that, and it turned out really badly, and we can't do that again." And of course, Pike's had experiences with timey-wimey stuff as well. So both of them are coming at it from different directions. And so she feels really strongly, you should have just let me die, because that would have been a better choice than doing this. But Pike's the kind of guy who's like, Pike's never going to do that, because he's not that man. He couldn't make a choice like that. And again, so another great opportunity, this time a little bit of friction between two of our main cast members. A lot of this book is me putting characters in my evil writerly way, putting characters into bad situations in a box, and then shake the box up a little bit and see what kind of pops out.
To your earlier point too, these characters are so well rounded and so well acted by their actors. You can just kind of throw a situation at them and see how they react. That's really cool.
Are you ready for more independence as a financial advisor? Consider the RIA model. Schwab Advisor Services has helped thousands of advisors make the move. To find your path, start with Schwab at advisorservices.schwab.com/paths today.
Positively Trek comes to you each week thanks to the efforts of our amazing Patreon members. If you'd like to help support the show, simply visit patreon.com/positivelytrek. Join at any level to get early access to ad-free episodes and exclusive content. For higher tiers, we offer shoutouts, associate producer credits, and more. We appreciate each and every one of our listeners. Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode. Live long and prosper. Before we move on to the next topic, I kind of want to settle a bet I have kind of going on with myself and my brain. The Baldwin, that's got to be a For All Mankind reference, right?
Absolutely is a For All Mankind reference. Yeah.
See, Bruce, you have to watch that show.
there's actually a nested, I mean, I love, let me just sidebar for a second. I love For All Mankind. I mean, yeah. I'm a huge NASA nerd, and that show is absolute catnip for me, So, when I was working on the outline for this, obviously we were rewatching some of the episodes, and I like the idea of naming the ships in the Freedom Class after astronauts. And I thought, oh, wouldn't it be fun if they were fictional astronauts? So, and in fact, if you look, there's Pelia talks about having served on a ship in the same class, and she says, "Oh, it's the USS Koenig," and that's a reference to
Yeah.
John Koenig, Commander Moonbase Alpha from the Space 1999 TV series.
Oh, nice.
There were other names I was considering was the Watney, after Mark Watney from The Martian, and Mason after Major Matt Mason, the little action figure, the little astronaut toy from the 60s. But I picked Baldwin because I just thought that, I liked Ed Baldwin as a character. And there's a scene when they're in the rec room and they're looking at the ship's mission patch on the wall. And the design and the description, that's the same mission patch that Apollo 15 has in For All Mankind, which
Oh,
again is just
nice.
putting in
Wow.
another little kind of reference in there, because I really like that show.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, I grinned when there was the line, like it kind of confirmed to me, oh, they were named after past astronauts. I was like, oh yeah, okay. That's a For All Mankind reference. That
You
made me
know,
very
so many
happy.
people have said, like, oh, For All Mankind is like the prequel to Star Trek. And I'm like, yeah, it could be. So maybe it is. Who knows?
Well, yeah, and then you also had mentioned earlier in the show focusing on Ortegas, and we get to see a relative, her great grand aunt. And I thought it was interesting because you could go to any of these characters and do a relative. And I'm just curious why you chose her. I guess because you wanted to give more focus on her character, but then also, are the writers of the show or Kirsten Beyer okay with you creating that? Or is that something they had is a distant relative in mind for her?
Well, from the start, the outlines, I said, like, I want to do a story for Ortegas. I want to do the kind of never meet your heroes. And this is, and it's a never meet your heroes, be careful what you wish for. I want to kind of play those notes. But I want to kind of drill into her background a little bit. And so when I presented the storyline, I said, well, we can talk about Beto, her brother, who you're going to see in season three, just as in passing, but I want to go back into her past and talk about more about like her inspirations. And I really like this idea that she'd had this kind of renegade auntie from her distant past. Well, I say distant, not distant from her point of view. This person who had been an influence on her, but she'd never met them. And they're this kind of the black sheep of her family, and she followed in this person's footsteps. There's a line in the story where she actually says to her, "You opened a door that I walked through." So that's kind of her relationship for this character. And so in her head, she has this idea of who this woman was, but when she meets her, she's not that person at all, and she's a completely different person, and she's quite spiky and quite unpleasant, at least at the beginning when she first meets her. And, as a kid, she has one view of this person, but what she realizes later on is that her family were always kind of like, don't talk about her, don't talk about Auntie Luciana, because she's the black sheep of the family. And there's this kind of underlying storyline about this character having left and gone off into space and done her own thing, but under a bit of a cloud. And the young version of Ortega, she didn't see that. She just saw somebody going off and having a cool adventure. And she's as a kid, she's thinking, I want to go do that. But as an adult, she realizes there's a lot more nuance to it. And it's much more complicated, as these things always are. And she finds herself in this situation of trying to reconcile her youthful, childlike vision of this person who inspired her with the actual version of the real person that she meets, who is not necessarily a bad person, but definitely not what she was expecting. And again, that was interesting to challenge that character and put her in that situation. So just to delve into her background, because it gives me an opportunity to put her front really cool conversations and just open up and explore more of that character's backstory.
Yeah, from where she's from, what her family's like. Yeah, it gives you that opportunity.
Yeah. And all of that stuff, we were kind of going backwards and forwards. That was all being sort of vetted and checked to make sure it kind of dovetails with what's going on in the show. And hopefully that connects up to make it kind of feel richer and stronger. When we were putting the artwork together for the cover, I remember the original pass of the artwork did not have Ortegas on the cover. And I went back to them and I said, because they'll put the art on like the text on the back of the book, the sort of like the one page outline. And I went back and I said, no, she needs to be on the cover because she plays a very, very important role. And it's not fair not to have that character front and center right there. So they
Oh,
added,
yeah.
well, and a really
Yeah.
nice as well was, yeah, there you go. There you see it right there. And when we started talking about that, we posted up that cover and I got a retweet on Twitter from Melissa Navia and she went, oh, that's really cool. And I thought, that's great. Ortegas herself has approved this, so I'm like, I'm very happy about that.
Well, a distant relative of Ortega's really approved it because we're in the 21st century. But anyway, but no, on this cover, it's like, yeah, you're right. I mean, it's great that she's there, but really, she could really be where Pike is in this,
Yeah, I mean, it's
right in the center.
I think it's definitely it's a Pike Ortegas novel, first and foremost. That's how I conjured it when I was first putting it together. Having said that, like I said, everybody gets some cool stuff to do. Una gets an opportunity to face off against kind of her opposite number on a Klingon battle cruiser, and that was fun for me because I love doing space battle stories. And I thought, how can I do a space battle story that will be different? And I thought Una's the kind of character who's not going to go in guns blazing. She's going to outthink, out-strategize this aggressive Klingon warrior, and that was really interesting to get into her head and get her in that situation where she's trying to fight a battle with the minimum amount of gunplay all the way through the story and the challenges and the stress and the tension that puts on her while Pike and everybody else is off the ship. She's the one in, how do I keep this all together without firing a shot?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. That was kind of my next big section I wanted to talk about was Una versus Bren and the IKS Pagor, because I really enjoyed that part of the novel. And again, like you said, Una kind of doing this strategic type battle, and the emphasis on her as an Illyrian versus an Earther, I thought was kind of a fun thing. Cause of course the Klingon, you know, "Oh, you Earthers." And she's like, "No, I'm not an Earther. You're dealing with something completely different here." That was so much fun. Bren, especially, she's so unpredictable, which must have been so much fun to write, but at the same time, also very cunning with like the mining the space around the rings and the Enterprise not expecting that. Were there any kind of specific inspirations for this type of character? Or I just imagine she must have been so much fun to write.
When I was trying to conjure up, because so I wanted to have a female Klingon commanding officer up against a female Federation officer. I thought that would be a fun thing to do. And then I just kind of looked at Una and I said, okay, how can I just invert everything about her? So I want to create this character who is this kind of reverse mirror of who Una is, and the person who would do the opposite of her of every situation. So she's absolutely a braggart, and she's bullish, and she's aggressive, and she's sly, and she lies, and she's just, you know, all the negative emotional reactions that Una would not have. That's this woman distilled down into everything that she is. And then looking at the timeline, I realized that, you know, we're still quite close to the war with the Klingons that we saw in Discovery. And I thought, oh, that gives me a kind of spur to create some of her backstory about the idea that she was involved in the war, and that she'd have been the one who'd have come to Earth and planted the flag if they'd have won. And so she's really salty about the fact that the war ended. So she's looking just to pick a fight all through the story. Every opportunity that Una says, like, "Well, you know, we could disengage from this. I'm giving you an out." She's like, "No, I don't want an out. I want to fight." And she keeps pushing and pushing and pushing. And Una's pushing back the other way, trying to, how can I get out of this without a fight? So it's the irresistible force and the immovable object. And the two of them, again, sort of like banging off each other. That's, you know, the sparks that fly between the two of them. And then the fun of doing the sort of like the tactics and stuff like that, you know, the space battle tactics, that's always cool to write.
It was so much fun to read, and how her own kind of aggression was ultimately her downfall, which was, you know, transporting herself. I love that line, "We literally knocked them into next week." That was great.
It's kind of like, you know, it's the "don't throw me in the briar patch" kind of situation at the end. You know, it's the Una outthinks her, right? Because she kind of gets, as the story goes on, she gets the measure of who this person is. And she realizes that, you know, because Bren doesn't have anything but top gear all the way through, she's always like full on everything. And once Una realizes that, oh, you know, you don't have anything else but that. So I can use that against you. And that's exactly what she does. She sets up the entire situation. Oh, you played yourself because you don't have the flexibility that I do. And that's why she wins, because Bren doesn't have, you know, she's just too focused, too aggressive. Doesn't have the ability to sort of step back. Whereas Una's kind of more three-dimensional rounded. That's why she wins. And that was fun to do that. And then I bring in Mbenga as like kind of the sort of her kind of the voice at her shoulder, you know? So, and he's like, you know, he's another fun character, you know, he's got such interesting depths and that sort of like shade of darkness running through him. He's like this dark and shady past in the special forces. And, you know, Una brings him in. And he's, I know this Klingon commander, you know, we've crossed swords before. And he was like, right, okay, I want you at my side because I want that skill, because I want that, you know, I want your knowledge to help me beat this person. And that was fun as well, just to have him there saying, like, he's going to test you. We're going to have to work hard to beat this one, and have the two of them working together. It takes Una out of her comfort zone. And it also takes Mbenga out of his comfort zone, because he's like, I don't really want to be doing this. I used to do this stuff. And now I'm past it. And she's like, yeah, but we need to save the ship. It's like, okay. So they both both have to take on this job, this challenge of beating this bad guy. At the same time, you know, trying to figure out where all their crewmates have gone. So again, it's like tension coming at them from all different directions.
Yeah, I really like that, because of his past with the Klingons, it made sense that he be there. And so we weren't seeing the doctor character of him like, oh, you know, let me take care of this patient. This is him dealing and helping her with the Klingons. And it reminded me of so many times when we would see McCoy standing there next to Kirk's chair, And McCoy's just there making comments. He doesn't really sometimes have a reason to be there, but Mbenga does. And he's, you know, kind of helping guide and let Una play off of him and decide, you know, what should come next. And he's just that voice of, oh, don't trust them. You know, they're going to do this. She's going to do that, you know. And that was really great to see that in his character and that relationship with Una.
Mm-hmm. And also, see, that's another reason why Bren loses, because Bren doesn't have someone like him. She doesn't have someone she can trust and confide in. And again, it's kind of coming back to like, well, you know, Starfleet works because people, diverse people, disparate people with different skill sets coming together to save the day. That's why Starfleet works. And the Klingon commander, she doesn't have that because she's so focused in like, no, I'm in charge. I'm the only one who makes any decisions. And that's kind of ultimately, you know, to leads to her downfall. And the idea of bringing those two characters together, bringing like, you know, the first officer and a doctor together into that situation is again, just taking them out of the roles that we've already seen them playing in the show and giving them something a little bit different to do. It's one of the things I wanted to do with this story was try to take characters who aren't usually put together and try to put them together. So they have different sort of relationships and also sort of breaking characters who've had relationships. Because this is kind of past the point where Spock and Chapel have had sort of like their kind of romantic interlude, and Chapel is part, Spock is not. And so when they're split, he's finding it really difficult to kind of concentrate on his work because he's really worried about her, and he still hasn't kind of rationalized his emotions about how he feels about her. And it's clouding his judgment as he's trying to deal with the situation.
Yeah, I appreciated that kind of touchstones of their relationship between the two of them being separated, and how like every once in a while it's like, oh, they'll be fine kind of thing. Like just yeah. We know who you're thinking about, but yeah, that was really
that
touching.
Moment when, you know, Pike says, oh, we lost somebody, and immediately he thinks, oh, please not her. And that's literally like his very first reaction is like, anybody but Christine, you know, and he feels bad about having that reaction, but that's like, oh, and you know, you can see that process going on. He's thinking, I've really got to sort this out. I've got to figure out what my feelings are towards her and how I move forward from here. And that to me feels very much like mid-season to Spock. That's where he is emotionally in those moments. And so I tried to make that kind of feel true to the character.
No, that was great. And also what you did with the other bridge crew characters that we don't get to see a lot, like Mitchell, for example, seeing more. That's the thing I love about the novels is we can explore, like you said, we have more time to explore different characters and their backgrounds, and it gives them more opportunities that we don't get on the show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, Mitchell's, she has a few fun moments as well. And because we're splitting the party basically in this story. So yeah, you have to bring in some of the sort of the more sort of side characters and give them a larger role, because otherwise it's like, well, who's sitting at that chair? Who's running that console? Well, it's this character. And if they're on screen, as it were, for longer, you need to build that up, give them a little bit more depth.
When I was nearing the end of the novel and we were coming up to the epilogue, I was thinking like, okay, the epilogue's going to be one of two things. And for the record, I think you made the right choice of what the epilogue should be. But I was like, I kind of want to see 1 week in the future and Bren and her ship reappear and just be enraged.
Just popping out in empty space and going, what? What? Yeah.
Absolutely. And I was thinking like, if this were kind of back in the day where there were, you know, a new Trek novel a month, or even at one point two a month, I thought that Bren would be just the perfect character to have as kind of this recurring antagonist that came back every once in a while. Like in Diane Duane's novels, she has kind of a whole set of recurring characters that came back repeatedly. Bren would just be so much fun because she would be so mad after this.
Yeah. I mean, I imagine, you know, it's like they say, you know, when they're talking about what's going to happen to her, and her ship is, like they say, time displaced a week into the future. So by the time they come back, it's like, what? But she's the kind of person, she's going to go back to headquarters and she won because she's the kind of person who could never defeat, but you know absolutely that she's going to go back into her quarters, carve Una's name in it with her batleth into the wall, and like, you know, I'll get you Una Chin Reilly, you know, she's definitely got a blood hatred oath against Una now. So yeah, I could quite easily see that character coming back, you know, with trying to basically get Una's head to hang on a trophy wall.
I do hope that we get to see her again in the future. I hope you get to write another Strange New Worlds novel, and featuring Bren somehow would be so much fun, I think. But even if this is all we get of her, she's a very memorable character, and that was so much fun seeing them face
That's
off.
great. That's what I was aiming for. Because she's like, you know, there's no nuance to her at all. She's just absolutely full on all the time. And that's why she's fun to write, because she's such a polar opposite to Una, who is all nuance, who is all kind of like, you know, there's so much going on below the surface, so many kind of layers to that character. And Bren is the exact opposite, just this kind of like force of kind of brutality, force of nature, just being propelled through the story by her own aggression. And that's why it's fun to sort of put two characters like that together and see what comes out.
One other thing I wanted to mention too before we get to the epilogue of the book, the giant bugs. Boy, if you wanted to find like the straight needle to my like nervous system of ugh, getting me while I'm reading this, I feel like Indiana Jones, but not with snakes. It's like, why did it have to be bugs? And there's one point in particular, the larva. I was like, I'm gonna be okay reading this as long as it doesn't mention lampreys. And then there was like, and the way it formatted in the ebook, it was like, and a ring of teeth like a, flip the page, lamprey. I'm like, ah. So kudos to you for just creeping me the F out with those.
Good job, James. Good job.
That's exactly what I was aiming for. Well, you know what it's like. I mean, you know, if you've anybody who's watching this who's never seen what they look like, Google a picture of a lamprey mouth. It's just this funnel full of wickedly hooked teeth. It's like absolutely anybody's going to look at that and be, you know, not only icked out, but also terrified if you think of that chomping on your leg. So yeah, you know, that was fun to write those, because I wanted to create, because part of the story is there's no villain in this story apart, well, Bren's a villain, but she's not the kind of driving force villain. There's no kind of master plan of some evil bad guy doing all this stuff to our heroes. It's just a kind of collection of systematic things that happen, and our heroes have to work their way through them. So the threat force I wanted to have on the planet where everybody gets stranded, I wanted that to be something environmental and something just like wickedly dangerous. And the more I thought about it, was like, how's this going to work with the kind of the environment I create? And I was like, this is the idea of this life form that goes through this insectoid life form that goes through these different stages. So you have the maggoty sort of lamprey mouth crawlers, and then you have the kind of the ones that kind of run around, the little stalkers, and then you have these big sort of like basically monster giant kaiju-esque dragonflies. And once I kind of got that idea in my head, I thought, well, okay, that's going to work as an interesting sort of threat for our characters to face, because they can't negotiate with that. It's not, you know, there's, I even put a line in where one of the characters says, did you try talking to them? And he's like, yeah, everybody who did that got eaten. So that didn't work. So we don't really have a choice here. It's either you run from these things or you fight them. And again, that was fun to put these characters into that kind of like, you know, that high octane, high pressure, high risk survival situation.
It was fun, but really creepy. It so visceral while reading it. It was that was fun to read.
I wish I could see your face, Dan, as you were reading
Just kind of like, yeah.
it. Somebody looks over, oh, that must be a good book. You look like you're really enjoying it.
Absolutely.
Oh, man. But yeah, those bugs are coming after them. And, you know, that leads us more towards the ending. Not quite the epilogue yet. But, you know, I would say that when I'm reading this book, it's almost like going to a concert and you're enjoying the concert, and it's a band that you like, and you're like, oh my gosh, I hope they play this song. Oh good, they did. Oh, I hope they play this song. Oh good, they did. That's how I was in this, because there were so many times I'm like, oh, I hope something like this happens. Oh good, you know, like Lon, like, oh good, she's gonna come back and be with us through the rest of the novel. But the way this ended, and there, I remember thinking, it's like I said earlier, that why not just tell the Makos, you know, they're going to die. You can tell them you're from the future. But then I was like, well, wait, if they're trying to get back to the 23rd century, take them with you. And I thought, maybe you'll go there, but then maybe they'll die. Something happens and they never make it through. And they did. And I love that because then it makes me wonder what their lives are like when they get to the 23rd century, which could do a follow-up novel or a short story to that. But I'm glad that you went there because it just made it more interesting to know that they're now out of place of their time and they have an adventure ahead of them.
I mean, again, this comes back to it's Pike who makes that decision, but ultimately, because he's in charge, right? He's the ranking officer. And he was never going to leave them behind, right? That's just not who he is. And once you get to that end decision, it's 100% logical because you know the kind of man that Christopher Pike is. He would never leave those people to die. He just can't do it. And even if taking them into the future is like there's some sort of bad effect of it, he looks at it and goes, well, it's, you know, I'm going to, of the choices that are in front of me, they're all equally bad, but this is the least bad choice, is to do this and screw the rules. And we'll, you know, I'll deal with, you know, if April puts me in manacles and throws me in the brig, that's fine. But I can't leave these people to die of radiation poisoning on this planet. And their past is kind of, what happened to them is vague enough that maybe there's a little bit of wiggle room, you know, within the wibbly wobbly timey wimey nature of things. And it's the logical choice that he makes. And even though it means these people are now time lost and they will go through a traumatic situation, it's better than being dead.
Yeah.
That's kind of, mm-hmm. that's the calculus that Pike has. You know, there's that whole conversation where when they reveal who they are and the characters say, well, look, can we have your spaceship and fly back to the starbase? He's like, I can't let you do that. Because you know, you're gonna mess with history, but you can come with us. And they have that revelation where it's like everybody thinks you're already dead, so there really isn't anything for you to go back to, except this. Come with us because you're Starfleet, and Starfleet will always need people like you, and you can still be that, just you know, 90 odd years into the future.
But is that really breaking the rules?
A little bit. It's you know, I wonder. You know, I felt like. It's the choice that Pike's going to make that choice no matter what. So at that point, I don't think he cares about whether that's is there a temporal prime directive at this point in Star Trek history? I couldn't find anything that kind of said there was. So I made a little joke about it in the story where one of the characters says, like, you know, maybe we should write down some regulations, like codify this if this stuff happens again in the future. But for now, we're going to make this choice and we're going to save these people's lives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, kind of appropriate because it's before it happens in time, so it's appropriate for time travel stuff. But yeah, he totally Gillian Taylored them. So
that's it.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think that there's got to be somewhere at Starfleet headquarters that there has to be a point. I don't know where it would be sometime maybe before TNG, like a special division of counselors working for Starfleet Medical whose job it is. To help people who are time lost in the same way that you would help somebody if you had someone who was a refugee from a different country settling into a culture that they weren't from and say, okay, well, this is how you settle into this culture. You'd have someone who would do that for people who are temporal refugees and say, okay, well, you're from the 20th century, or this is the 23rd century, and this is the things that are different, and here's how we're going to ease you into that world. So I think there must be somebody like, maybe that's what Gillian Taylor ended up doing. Maybe she started, I like the idea of that, is that maybe that was the job she ended up having in the future, you know. So people like, was it, I can't remember, the captain that Kelsey Grammer played.
Yeah, Captain Bateson, yeah.
Yeah, Bateson, Morgan Bateson, right? Him and his crew, right? They ended up stranded in the TNG time period. And that's a whole crew full of people. What happened to them? It's a similar situation, you know.
Yeah.
Did they end up going on? I know there was, I think it was Diane Carey did a novel about those characters and brought those characters back. So the idea of them being able to find a new place for themselves in the future, the same as the guys from Neutral Zone who were, you know, frozen in the suspended animation capsule. You know, this is not something that doesn't happen. It happens a lot in Star Trek universe. There must be some sort of mechanism that exists for helping these people kind of reassimilate.
I feel like Christopher Bennett had something like that as part of the Department of Temporal Investigations in his novel. I think the homemaker from the Neutral Zone was like part of that department, like a counseling department or something. So yeah, that's, I want to see more of that. That would be interesting for sure. So yeah, the epilogue of the novel. Now I think, Bruce, you had some thoughts on on this because this was really cool.
So, towards the end of the novel, this is what I'm getting back to. Ooh, you're hitting all the right notes with me, okay? You're playing the right songs. Because when it was said that, the Sakaari are going to, when their planet's ready, several centuries from now, they'll come out to their world and continue to live. And I latched on to it saying many centuries or several centuries, and I thought, oh my gosh, wouldn't it be cool if there was a follow-up novel where they come out and the Discovery crew's there, or the Starfleet Academy series characters, you know, which we're not familiar with yet, but whenever this novel came, we would see that. And I get to the epilogue and I see Keel coming out and I'm like, oh, okay, that's cool. Yeah, yeah. And we're getting to see, and then he sees these four humanoid figures. And I was like, no, really. And it was the Discovery crew. And I'm just like, thank you so much for doing that. That was a great surprise.
Thank you. Well, I mean, I got to be honest, that wasn't in the original version of the outline when I started writing the story. And as I was putting it together, I was like, oh, yeah. And then you know, they go back into the thing and they'll be in suspension for, and originally it was going to be millions of years, thousands and thousands, or maybe millions. You know, it was the kind of like TBD years, but a long, long, long time. Centuries, millennia. And then I thought, wait a second, if I bring that number in a little bit, I can totally make this a surprise Discovery cameo at the end. Because and I looked at my numbers and I thought, this actually, I can make this work. So I remember I talked to Dayton Ward about it, about the timelines, and I said to him, what do you think about this? And he said, yeah, he said, if you kind of put the date of return here, the Discovery cast crew, Discovery crew will be doing this, and this is in the gap between these episodes, it would work. So I said, yeah, let's go for it. So Dayton, you know, helped me out with that. And it was just fun to do that, just to have this random moment at the back of the story. Is, you know, you think this, it's the end of credits, post-credit stinger, right, in a novel and that kind of thing. Keel, the alien character, he steps out of the gateway and he's like, oh, okay, well, you know, the planet's fine now and time has passed. And the last thing that Pike says to him before he goes down to the planet is, Pike shakes his hand and he says, you know, we won't meet again, but I promise you, we'll make sure, Starfleet will make sure that your planet is protected and no one will mess with you while you're asleep. And yeah, and it's Pike making a promise like he always does. And I thought, it's perfect that Burnham is the person who resolves that promise. And the idea that he kept that promise, and all through these hundreds of years, somebody from Starfleet has been every now and then going back to this planet and just checking to make sure everything's fine and fixing the device and making sure there's no problems with it. And it works really well because Burnham and Pike knew each other. Yes. That's why that makes it really resonant. So, you know, when she meets the alien guy, she says, oh, we have a friend in common, Christopher Pike. We both knew that guy. And so immediately that kind of gives them that kind of very simple, basic emotional connection. And they shake hands and she's like, welcome to the future. You know, everything's great. And, you know, and it's the closing of that loop, Pike's promise and Burnham's kind of fulfillment of it gives a nice kind of emotional closure to the story.
Yeah, I loved that because I wonder if it was very similar to your process of writing it, because kind of just as I was coming up to the epilogue, I was like, just like Bruce, like, wouldn't that be neat if ... Sure enough, I'm like, yes.
I wasn't sure if I would be allowed to do it because, you know, it's like, am I crossing the streams here? This is a Strange New Worlds novel. Am I allowed to do a kind of like a Discovery epilogue in here? But they were like, no, go for it. It works.
Yeah.
And that's the fun with doing, you know, time travel stuff. So this is, in a way, this novel has kind of stealthy, well, I say stealthy connection. It has connections to the events of Star Trek Beyond. It has connections to the events of Star Trek Enterprise. It's obviously connected to the events of Strange New Worlds, but then began to drop this one extra connection in. Oh, it's also connected to future Discovery too. To me, that was just so much fun to be able to get that in there.
Well, it's kind of neat because the events of the novel technically span almost the entire Star Trek history to just a few years after the formation of the Federation all the way up to the 32nd century. You got it covered. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, because when they go into their suspended animation, that's kind of like, you know, in the, for us, it's like the 14th century.
Right, yeah.
The time that they go in. So yeah, it does. It spans the entire history of the known Federation.
Yeah. Well, in my head canon, that while they're in suspension and Starfleet is taking care of that device, the Cerritos is one of those starships that went to check on it.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's right. That's canon. Yeah, absolutely. It would be.
Oh, I love
it. Yeah. I can imagine sort of like, you know, Boimler, you know, playing around with Tendi. Don't touch that. Don't touch that thing.
Oh, that's great. Now I've already got an episode in my head where like three of them go into it but are only in there for a day and they have to cover for them before they come out again.
That would be a great short story. It's a shame that Star Trek Explorer magazine is not running anymore.
Oh, yeah.
It's a short story, a little addendum story.
Yeah.
Oh, that'd be great. Awesome. Well, that pretty much covers the whole novel. Is there anything that we haven't talked about that you wanted to mention with regards to the novel?
Not really. I mean, no, you guys kind of hit all of the marks there. I mean, I just want to say how much fun I had doing this. I really had an absolute blast just sort of like getting hold of these characters. Because I've had such fun watching Strange New Worlds. And then it's always fun as a writer to be able to get given the keys to the car and say, like, you want to drive this around a little bit and have some fun with it. And that was really awesome. And there's so much in this novel that just comes from stuff that I think is fun. And I had an opportunity to pull from lots of different places and kind of weave a story together that hits a lot of marks that personally made me happy. And I hope that the readers are going to feel the same way about it.
Excellent. Well, speaking for myself, I loved this novel. Like I said, I just finished reading it the day before we recorded this. And edge of my seat the entire time. It was so much fun to read. And all the little bits where you had something for every character to do and something that was like important to each of their characterizations. I think that was my favorite aspect of it. So, anybody listening or watching us on YouTube, if you've gone this far and you haven't read this novel yet, as always, I question your life choices, but go out and grab it because it's an excellent book and one of my favorites now for sure.
Yep. And preparing for the show, it's like, okay, I have so many days to get this read before we record. And that wasn't a problem because I would read it and go, oh, just one more chapter. Then I'd read yes. Just one more chapter. You know, so it was going good. It was going well. So yeah, I loved it. It was a lot of fun.
Thank you very much for that, Bruce. That's always lovely to hear that. I always try to infuse my books with that kind of just one more chapter kind of thing. I feel like that's kind of one of my strengths as a writer. So I'm always happy when people say, oh, I couldn't put it down. Oh, I stayed up all night reading it. I'm like, great. That's really what I was aiming
for. I thought about staying up all night, but I knew that wasn't going to work well for me the next day.
You get the audio book, just lie in bed, listen to Robert Peck. Who, you know, he's got a lovely voice.
Yeah, absolutely. So is there anything that you have on the go that you can tell our listeners about that they'd be interested in, Star Trek or otherwise?
There's a bunch of stuff I'm working on, which is all very heavily non-disclosure agreemented, so I can't talk about it. I'm working on a games project right now, which is super secret, and I'm working on a new standalone thriller novel, which is also super secret. But beyond that, I've just recently done some work for the Gerry Anderson Corporation, the producers of the very famous British science fiction shows, stuff like Thunderbird, Space 1999, and those kind of things. I did a couple of tie-in novellas for them, original. It's the first time they've had anything written for those franchises that's new since the 1970s. So I did a Space 1999 tie-in novella called The Armageddon Engine and a UFO novella called Shadow Play. Again, really, really fun to have the opportunity to write for these two IPs, these franchises from the 1970s that I grew up watching, that I never thought there would be an opportunity to kind of tell a story in those universes with those characters. And Jamie Anderson, the son of Gerry Anderson, the creator of these shows, got in touch with me and said, like, you know, would you like to write these? And I practically bit his hand off to do it. So I had a really good time working on those. So those have just been out recently. And he asked me to come back again to do some work on some comic books for the 60th anniversary of another one of those shows, which is Stingray, which is this underwater adventure with puppets and cool submarines, to do some comic book stuff on that. So that's the other stuff I've been working on recently.
And if people want to keep up with what you're working on, is there anywhere online they can follow you?
Come to jswallow.com, which is my website. You can find me on most of the socials. I'm on Twitter, X, what have you, Mastodon, Blue Sky. But yeah, come to my website and you'll find pretty much everything you need to know about me, my stuff, my work, and what I'm working on right now.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. This was so much fun. It's always, like I said, it's an event when a new novel comes out, and especially when one is as much fun to read as this one was. It's great to talk to you about it for sure.
Thanks very much, guys. I'm
Yes.
really glad you enjoyed it.
And also, as of to the day we're recording this, I want to wish you a happy May the 4th.
Oh, yes.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Excellent. Well, thank you all so much for listening and watching along with us. And thanks once again to James Swallow and my co-host, Bruce Gibson. As always, stay positive. Positively Trek is produced and edited by me, Dan Gunther, and co-produced by Barry DeFord on Treaty 8 territory, the home of the Beaver, Cree, Dene, and Métis people, whose histories, languages, and cultures we respect. We acknowledge the many First Nations, Métis, and Inuit who have lived in and cared for these lands for generations.